Beware, spoilerphobes! You have stumbled into a storm of spoilers, a Star Wars special where we will join thousands of previously written think pieces and boldly suggest that Star Wars is a story world full of politics. There are political metaphors all over the place, even involving the space wizards. When did this all start? How did George Lucas accidentally write himself into relevance with the prequel trilogy? We're going to answer those questions by asking some different questions. Be aware that we're mostly focusing on the movies, but discussion can rapidly expand to include any Star Wars media, like interviews with George Lucas and Star Wars The Clone Wars Season 3 Episode 10, Heroes on Both Sides. We're not ruining, at least not with this podcast. It's enrichment time. Hello, I'm Dave Gonzalez, and I'm a Sith.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I'm a smuggler who doesn't want to be part of all this nonsense, but I'm getting sucked in anyway.
And welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers. Before we get started today, just letting you know what's going to happen on this feed, which you are hopefully subscribed to in your podcast devices. We're going to take a break next week and then come back on the 6th of August with our Alien Earth preview special. That's right, we are going to be watching Alien Earth. It airs Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Hulu starting on the 12th. And our podcast will continue to come out, as you might have guessed, with the August 6th deadline on Wednesdays, so we could give you that snap reaction to whatever Noah Hawley's cooking up over there in that franchise world. The preview special and the Alien Earth episodes will see the return of the Calm and Storm sections, because Neil, I don't know if you saw the most recent trailer for Predator Badlands, but it seems to be part of the Alien franchise.
Hell yes.
So if you want to just watch Alien Earth with us, there'll be a Calm section for you. If you want to talk about how Alien Earth is affecting the entire Alien franchise, there will be a Storm section for you. That's usually how this podcast goes, but not this week, because we're just talking about Star Wars and politics. If you want to email us, you could send us a raven at stormofspoilers@gmail.com. You could also help this podcast by reviewing and rating us on the Apple Podcasts app and Spotify. We would love a 5-star rating, and you could say whatever you want. Like Start Meg, who gave us 5 stars and said, "Friends everywhere, I have listened to you guys for years, and although I was bummed you had to be parted from Joe, it inspired me to engage with you guys in other ways, like tuning into Neil playing out The Last of Us, a genuine delight. I also just listened to my first ad willingly because you guys are wonderful and know your audience. Thankful for you guys." We are thankful for you. Thanks for sticking around for so long.
Thanks for listening to the ad.
Yeah.
Didn't
if you're
have
in
to do
San
that,
Diego, but go see Joanna Robinson in Hall H. She's got some great stuff going on.
Oh, yeah. That's fun.
If you would like more of Neil and I, we are on YouTube now at youtube.com/@DA7EANDNEIL. We have put all of these Star Wars episodes covering Andor and this one on YouTube in their entirety for you to both watch, see our new shirts, and, you know, maybe share along with people who need some visuals of who's talking to them. You can join us at patreon.com/DA7EANDNEIL for bonus content from all the previous seasons of Storm of Spoilers. That's your Game of Thrones, that's your off-seasons tours, that's your Lost, the rewatch podcast, which I recommended to some people in real life this last weekend. They were thrilled to hear that Damon Lindelof pulled a fast one on all of us. you can figure out what that is on this podcast and get bonus content at patreon.com/DA7EANDNEIL. We also do weekly pop culture adventure episodes. We've been talking about all 5 Fantastic Four movies, and access our Patreon Slack, best place on the internet. And if you really, really need more, Neil and I are watching Hannibal. He's watching it for the first time all the way through. I'm rewatching it. We're eating the Rood together with some murder and food porn, sometimes too close together. Yep. Come on over to Patreon and join us.
The horngriest show. Horny and hungriest show of all time.
The horngriest show of all time. that's what that should have been our podcast name, is Come with the Horngry. But we're not talking about Hannibal or Alien Earth this week. We are still talking about Star Wars and politics right after this. This episode of Storm of Spoilers is brought to you by Indivisible. If you attended the No Kings protests a few weeks ago, you probably saw signs referencing Andor. I saw a lot of people carrying I Have Friends Everywhere signs, and Tony Gilroy made no secret about his participation in the protest in New York.
Andor might be taking place in a galaxy far, far away, but the connections to what's happening in this country are inescapable. We're seeing a steady march by a tyrannical regime against our communities and our rights. They hide behind countless atrocities, but we know oppression is the mask of fear. They know there are more of us, and regular people are already rising up with acts big and small to defend their neighbors and what remains of our aspiring democracy. One organization that's helping people throughout the country enlist in the cause is Indivisible. They are the primary group behind the No Kings protests and a daily source of actions people can take to overcome this fascist onslaught.
Indivisible has grassroots groups working day in and day out in every corner of the country to protect our rights and find meaningful ways to defy the Trump regime. Visit their website at indivisible.org to get connected, join a local group, or enroll in their trainings on strategic defiance to fight authoritarianism. You can also sign up at indivisible.org/friendseverywhere for more info. All right, here we go. I have a list of questions that I thought would be a way for Neil and I to talk about, is Star Wars political? Because this is a question that I think is brought up as like a bad faith argument by a lot of people reviewing, especially new Star Wars, where they're like, get my woke out of Star Wars. And to Neil and I, that seems a little weird. It seems like Star Wars might be a little inherently political. So I don't want to make Neil read any more than he already has. And I'm sure Neil thinks that I've read more than I actually have. So together, we're going to ask each other these questions and come to a storm of spoilers response that hopefully, you know, provokes some thinking and or questions when you're watching Star Wars or discussing Star Wars with people. If you're discussing politics with people, I do think it's important. You just heard an ad for Indivisible. That's a company that's trying to actually do things. I think conversations about Star Wars can be about like influences, can be about like mirroring real politics. I do think it's not necessarily a good idea to one-to-one propose solutions. I think, Neil, you and I ran across this way back in the 2016 elections, where they're like, Hillary is this Game of Thrones character, and Trump is this Game of Thrones character, and that didn't do anything outside of reducing some very real issues to sort of like nonsense memes.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually very unhelpful because it sort of just like flattens the, it takes a lot of the nuance out of the real life political discourse, which the nuance is actually very important in that case.
Absolutely. So Neil, when we say Star Wars is political, what does that mean?
Well, I guess there's two ways to think about this. Is one is Star Wars interested in the politics of its story world? Is one question. And two, is Star Wars influenced by the politics of the real world? And I think yes to both, right? Is it influenced by the politics of the real world? Absolutely. George Lucas, when he wrote the original Star Wars, was heavily influenced by the Nixon presidency, the Vietnam War, anti-imperialism that was represented by the struggle of the Viet Cong. He was also deeply influenced by like the American Revolution as an idea, right? Just this idea of like this, the plucky rebellion, the little guys banding together against all odds, against the big empire, right? And in the American Revolution, that's the British, and in the Vietnam War, that is America. And I think that it's also, you know, especially the aesthetic of the Empire is very reminiscent of the Nazis in World War II, right? I mean, they're literally called stormtroopers. That's a direct reference to what Nazi soldiers were called. So, like, is it influenced by the politics of when it was created? Absolutely. The other thing I think is very important is, like, I don't know. Some people get this distorted view of, like, what politics is. And they, you know, I guess don't seem to think about it in the simplest of terms, right? Because, you know, at the simplest level, politics is just having an opinion about the way like your social systems operate and are governed, right? And I think George Lucas has a very deep interest in, especially the Star Wars movies that he made, in the way that these social systems in this galaxy function, right? The way the government is set up, the way, you know, different ideologies rise and fall within this story world, the way that it impacts the lives of the people in this story world. So like, you know, that is inherently a political thing that he is doing, is being interested in the way this society, this very large galactic society, tries to govern itself. And you know, the fact that that reflects a lot of what was happening in the world is just because art is made by humans, and humans are, you know, inherently political beings, because it is as simple as, like, again, having an opinion about the way society is run, right? Like, for example, if you live somewhere where there's like public transportation and you just think that it's very poorly run, and you think, man, they should really just make a public transportation system that runs on time, that in itself is a political opinion that you have, you know?
Yeah.
So it is, I think, important to note that, like, not all art is deeply interested in the politics of its own story world. Even not even all Star Wars is necessarily that interested in the politics of its story world, which I'm sure we'll get to. But definitely where it came from, George Lucas had that on his mind. He wanted to explore how these social systems work. And then I think, you know, this is going to sound very basic, but it's extremely true. War, which is, you know, conflict between two entities within these social systems, usually like countries or, you know, two large entities, is an inherently political act. So, like,
yeah,
what are we doing here? If you're saying Star Wars isn't political, I did, Dave, dive into some of the arguments that Star Wars is not political.
Yes, the counterpoints.
Just because I was fascinated, and there are plenty of YouTube videos that will try to explain that. You know, I think a lot of it revolves around the prequel trilogy, and saying that, like, the direct parallels aren't as important because George Lucas was writing them before, you know, before George Bush got into office, which we can unpack that when we get to those movies. But a lot of it is built around this idea that George Lucas is like, it's a movie for 12-year-olds. So, like, it's not that deep. It's like a shallow thing. And therefore, it doesn't matter. And it's only because people are more political now that they are reading into Star Wars as some sort of political thing, which I think really does overlook or diminish the importance of, like, authorial intent, right? George Lucas has told us very clearly that he intended this to be an analogy to the struggle of the Viet Cong. And what I thought was funny is that, like, I got all the way to the end of this video that was, like, about the fallacy of Star Wars being political. And the author of the video revealed themselves to pretty much, like, they only seem to think that the Viet Cong analogy applies to the Ewoks and not the rebellion overall.
Right.
And I'm like, all right. The video did a good job of not being overtly racist until that moment where I was like, come on, man. And so I think, you know, it you have to be very selective and take out quite a bit of what George Lucas has literally said about the franchise to arrive at a take like it's not political. Again, it's about a war.
Yeah, definitely.
Right? It's at the very least a movie about, you know, people banding together against an authoritarian regime. Like, it's not subtle. So
I like your extremely nuanced and detailed answer. I would just go, like, everything's kind of political, but that's the sort of thing that gets me kicked out of parties. So I understand and I appreciate your take on it as well.
Humans make art. Humans are inherently political on pretty much every level. It's very rare to meet someone who is truly, many people claim to be apolitical, but like no one is. Everyone has political opinion. Everyone has a take on how shit is run around here, and that is political. So like there's no such thing as being completely apolitical.
Yeah.
So if that's true about humans, then that's also true about human made art.
And I also like the idea of political art being like a discussion or a dialectic of like different points of view. I don't want to say like Star Wars is political, like, you know, the Bible's political, because that's basically trying to teach people how to be like good humans. And the Force, I think, has a lot of conversations about what it means to be a good human when you wield something like power. And I think that's all fantastic, but it's like actually more on the politics side for me than it is on like the religious side for me when we talk about something like the Force. So that's going to be probably my angle going into it. But
Well, and you're also dealing with a lot of like metaphor and symbolism, right? In a piece of art. So as we can talk about, there is a lot of what I would call political tofu here.
Yeah.
Which is like, depending on what you bring to the conversation, you could come away with two completely different. Like I read over the course of this week researching for this, several compelling, they didn't like change my mind about what Star Wars means, but like logically well thought out arguments for Star Wars having a conservative bent. And it's based on like a like an old school conservatism, not this whole like neo-Nazi new conservatism that we've got going on. But like they really lean into this idea that it's not necessarily just about Vietnam. It's about the American Revolution and that struggle against the tyranny of the British oppressors. And then what George Lucas was really talking about was our fight against the oppression of communism in the 60s and 70s. And I was like, George Lucas was not an anti-communist. he grew up in the Bay Area in the 1960s. I believe he was on the other side of that argument, but you can see how people, if they're looking for that, can find those ideas in Star Wars, in the Rebels, right? The Rebels are for freedom, they're for independence from, you know, fascists and what was being promoted as like the communist agenda, which was like homogeny across society and like full control over your life and all of these like totalitarian ideas, which was the sort of 60s, 70s, 80s version of scare tactics around communism, socialism, etc.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you could get two completely different reads on Star Wars that both pretty much make sense, but are both deeply political.
I do think that's pretty great, and I do think you've led us perfectly into our starting point. We're going to go through the chronological release order here with our questions, so we are starting with the original trilogy. But you were sort of talking, and the interesting thing, at least for me, from somebody who went to college for screenwriting, is there was a period of time before I gave any of this any thoughts that we're about to talk about, where I would have been like, Star Wars is the hero's journey, is a theory Joseph Campbell came up with by studying the myths of other things. And I think the power of those sort of like myths that allow us to sort of tell cultural stories that grow up, I think what's one of the powers of Superman that's in theaters right now, is there is a allure to being vague enough to get both sides of the aisle in your big action blockbuster story.
Sure.
Which I think is what the original Star Wars does so well, is it has a lot of things in it that you have learned about through like reading what George Lucas's intentions were and that some people have put onto it with like hindsight. But when it comes out, it's like in the 70s, it's just like this big blockbuster on a scale that we've never seen before. We start Darth Vader's lifting people up by the neck. Luke Skywalker just wants to get out of there, which is like a really common theme in a lot of hero's journey fiction is, you know, you were sort of born in the wrong place. And then sometime in the middle of your life, you know, someone comes along and takes you off to the magical world where you're a prince or you're a princess or you have some magical power, and that you weren't just a useless moisture farmer on a desert planet. You were the most important person in the galaxy. So with all of that in mind, do you think in the original trilogy, America is the empire, or is America, like you were talking, the American Revolution, the World War II, maybe, where it's like, oh, there are some Nazis over there, we have to go help everybody else?
I do think that it's probably more likely. It is more deeply, especially the way that the rebellion conducts itself, is in this more guerrilla warfare style that leads me to believe that it is more heavily based on the Vietnam War, right? I feel like that was far more fresh in George Lucas's mind in the early 80s, right? And he was also, again, affected by Richard Nixon's presidency and this idea of like the power and authority of the executive branch that is something that we're dealing with again now, because history has this history, like Star Wars has a cyclical thing it going rhymes. On where it rhymes over and over again. But, you know, those being his, I think, most significant influences, but, you know, and, but then again, it's kind of hard to, it's easy to then see it the other way, right? Because there's so much aesthetically about the empire that reads as Nazi Germany.
Yes.
You know, so you can very quickly turn it into the rebels are the allies, and they're fighting against the rise of fascism. That's just because, you know, history rhymes. It's just a different empire each time.
Well, George Lucas probably thought, you know, it was a great idea. Well, what happens if I apply Nazi aesthetics to America? Maybe they would get it.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people didn't necessarily get it.
Yeah, I mean, because as he correctly diagnosed, in Vietnam, America was the empire.
Yeah. I think the big tell here for me is the Death Star and how beat up everything the rebels have versus how pristine and giant
the power
weaponry.
Gap.
The power
in
gap.
In weaponry.
The resource gap.
Which I think is a really good metaphor. Again, this is something that George Lucas may have had on his mind in the early 80s for nuclear proliferation, right, at the end of the Cold War, which is this idea that the reason why America was able to become this dominant empire in the modern age is because of the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And because America, as we remember from school, is the only country to ever use a nuclear weapon, right? Like, on a civilian population, on any, in any act of war, other than like testing it out in the middle of a field somewhere.
Plenty we definitely of blew up Jeddah. We definitely blew up Alderaan.
Yeah. So like this idea that, you know, there is this entity with overwhelming power that is able to just like exert its will however it wants anywhere in the galaxy or anywhere around the globe. It's hard to not see America of the 70s and 80s in the empire, you know?
Yeah. I think the one thing that the empire does very early on that is kind of yada yada away that luckily America doesn't get to in the Star Wars universe really until the prequel trilogy is they do dissolve the Senate at the very beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. Tarkin says that very quickly. So it's not like a key plot necessarily to what's been happening, but that is sort of like, I think, supposed to signal a tipping point about why this is so much worse.
That the democracy has already, at that point, been given away.
Correct. You know? Which I do think,
George is going to come back and make three more movies about how the democracy was given away later.
Right. No. I do think he also sort of, I don't know, saddles himself with a problem there. Because he's like, okay, so Senate's gone. Not a problem for these movies. because, you know, that's an important thing not to make a problem. When he has to go back and he has to be like, how did that happen? That's where I think the prequel trilogy really starts bringing in some other, like, just non-hero's journey ideas. The original trilogy is a really interesting story about Luke Skywalker eventually forgiving his family and blowing up a couple of Death Stars with his friends. But the prequel trilogy has to just be like setting up a bummer over three movies of technical advancements. But we're not there quite yet. I do want to ask you specifically about the narrative of the original trilogy by asking you what we think Empire Strikes Back is trying to tell us morally, politically. So tell me if this is a lazy understanding of what happens in Empire Strikes Back. But Luke's mentor, to make him better at the Force, which he had great help with fighting the rebellion, blowing up the Death Star, he decides he needs to learn more because, of course, Obi-Wan Kenobi is dead. And Obi-Wan Kenobi tells him, go see Yoda. So he goes to see Yoda. Meanwhile, Vader sets this huge trap for him. And Yoda tells him, you can't go save your friends, but you're going to stop your training. And that means you are at like a high risk of turning to the dark side, because we don't know it now, but we know, or we don't know it when Empire Strikes Back is playing out, but we do know it in the history of the Star Wars universe that this is sort of like the Jedi's thing. The more attachments that you have, the worse it's going to be. Sure. And Luke's like, no, why would I abandon my friends like that? He goes to Cloud City, forces this showdown, and instead of wiping out Luke Skywalker, the man who blew up the Death Star, instead, Darth Vader is like, sets a trap for who turns out to be his son. And he does basically the opposite Yoda, where he's just like, join me. I'm the one who knows how to use this power that you have. Come be part of the Empire. So is it just two older people talking to a young person and being like, vote Republican or vote Democrat? Like, we realize that you're a power player here in this conflict, and they're both trying to like lure him over.
I mean, I could see where, I could see how you could get there. Because I do think that, yeah, part of it is a conversation with like the next generation, right? You're the ones who could save it or doom it. One way or the other. I think, and listen, this is a very 2025 read, I'm going to admit. But like, when I look back at that, I see this, if I'm going to give George Lucas prescience or like credit for being prescient, this notion that it's almost a recognition that in this next era of defeating things like fascism or authoritarianism, that propaganda and information are going to be the more important avenues for recruitment for either side. And I think that's actually borne out over the last, what, 40 years since this movie came out?
Sure.
Is this idea that, you know, that it's about how the next generations are propagandized to and recruited to one side or the other as things get more and more polarized, so that the ideology can live on, right? So that even if the Empire dies, even if the Empire gets their shit rocked several times, like multiple Death Stars being blown up, they'll eventually come back, right? The ideology of the Sith, the ideology that they use to form this Empire, will never truly die, because they've indoctrinated enough of the next generation, enough of the important, next generation. So, and it's that, or it's also like a message to the lazy ass Gen Xers. It's like, oh, if you watch too much TV, we're going to get fascism, which is also something that is kind of borne out, but like each generation has their different distraction that has allowed stuff like fascism to fester. Which is like, for the Gen Xers, it was their MTV. They were too busy watching MTV and fascism grew. And then, for our generation, for the elder millennials, it's like video games were the first one. And then the internet came along and not only distracted people, but accelerated a lot of these things by creating echo chambers, by giving people access, more readily giving people access to ideas and other people that they may have not have had access to prior to that. So I don't want to give too much credit to George Lucas, because again, he's making a series of adventure films for 12-year-olds. But there's a little bit of truth there, where it's like The Empire Strikes Back does seem to recognize that propagandizing to the next generation is part of what this war is all about. Part of the political endgame of this war is making sure that you get the right people on your team so that your ideas survive and outlive you.
Yeah. Also, the older I get, the more I'm side-eyeing Yoda in Empire Strikes Back for being like,
Yoda's pretty nihilist.
Yeah.
Like, he's obviously, but he's also, he's been through some shit, right? Like, we can't underplay how terrible Order 66 is.
That's true.
For the Jedi. And how much guilt the Jedi might be carrying around in this period, right? I think one of the questions that I had, which is kind of a weird question, and again, there's nothing to indicate that this was like George Lucas's authorial intent here, but I'm interested in the way that the Force, especially now that we've had like Andor, and it's not a show that is very successful and not deeply interested in the Force.
Yeah.
Is how much we can read the existence of the Jedi as a sort of cautionary tale about the separation between religion and politics, or the separation between church and state.
Ooh, yeah. Right?
Because I think about the failure of the Jedi to ever bring balance or peace to this galaxy. They've pretty much never been able to do it. Not until the very end of the sequel trilogy do they even like come close. And we still kind of don't know if they do it. They just like get rid of one dude at the end who is supposedly all the Sith.
I will say there are some moments in the High Republic series where it does seem like the Jedi are trying to do good things. But you also saw the Acolyte, so they're also stealing babies. So like, we balance it out a lot.
So if you think about the Jedi as like this religious group who believes in this, who religiously believes in the Force as this, godlike energy in the universe, their role in government is interesting. And the fact that, especially when we get to the prequel series, that they're very closely aligned as like, almost like this religious police force. It's kind of fascinating how deeply they are involved in the downfall of this whole society.
Yeah.
And this government, right? Like maybe this society would have been a little bit better off if they wouldn't have trusted the Jedi with so much, right? Because then the Sith wouldn't have been able to infiltrate, maybe. And, they would have had like a police force that couldn't have all been murdered at once with one order. I don't know.
Yeah, I will say we're going to talk about this a little bit more in the prequel trilogy, but I love it coming up organically here because the whole idea.
I imagine Yoda feels guilty about all that. Is what I'm saying.
I just think like George Lucas came up with the idea of the Force, I think like vaguely from like, I don't know, some vague understanding of Eastern religions that he had in like the mid 70s, which is good. However, this sort of like unattachment thing is a really bad mantra for the light side Jedi, if you will, in the era of the Galactic Republic and Galactic War, because I would say in times when democracy is in turmoil, whether it's imperial rule or whether it's the beginnings of imperial rule, it's actually the ability to extend empathy that's going to keep you on the side that your morals align with. I think if anyone's telling you not to care and to look at the facts, I think that's a way to manage large groups of people. And as I do want to say, is part of why we elect people, the burden of electing leaders who can do these things, the burden of electing your own sheriffs even. is hopefully these are people that are dealing with like the large percentage issues. But when you're talking about a person to person, especially in a hero's journey story where you're talking to 12-year-olds and being like, you could be the Jedi, you could be Luke Skywalker, it is very dangerous to say that fear is an emotion and all emotion leans to the dark side.
Yeah.
I don't think like that's necessarily the best way to go about it. And it's interesting how the overall, I guess, snappiness of how Empire Strikes Back moves through its story, where basically Han and Leia are part of a chase that lasts the whole movie, and Luke is off having conversations with Yoda about what he's supposed to be doing. That ultimately Yoda's like, you gotta let your friends die if you're gonna win this fight.
Sure.
And is wrong.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting too, because this idea of upholding the Jedi as, you know, heroes and having them buy into like stoicism essentially is another one of those avenues where Star Wars sort of leaves the door open for people to see John Wayne, right? And to see this Batman. More stoic idea of a conservative, more stoic and conservative ideal in these movies, which I think is fascinating and again contributes to this notion of like political tofu, where it's like if you're looking for these to be parallels of, you know, truth, justice in the American way, you can find it in Star Wars if you really look hard enough. You know, it kind of falls apart when you get to the prequel trilogy, but you know, we'll get there. So
falls apart or gets more poignant.
This idea that if you're experiencing too many emotions, that is inherently a bad thing. Not great.
I mean, it's the balance. It's the melding of the thing that I was saying I was worried about at the beginning. Like if you take religion and you meld it with laws, that's going to be trouble, because religion is supposed to be about creating community and setting down a way to live your life that is, you know, respectful of whatever the morals of your religion are. My understanding of what a government is everybody trying to do the best as possible, but it's like, it's a churning thing. We're repealing laws. We're adding laws. We're trying to make sure we're giving as many people a leg up as we can without like shoving people down. Obviously, me just saying that sounds like we shouldn't tax billionaires. So that's where nuance enters in, like the government's this big nuance churn.
As simply as I could put it, the idea of the Constitution of the United States being like a living document that changes over time versus like the idea of the Ten Commandments.
Right.
Which have literally not changed since apparently that dude came down from the mountain with them. So like, you know, that's sort of the idea, where it's like religion gives you these foundational moral ideas, whereas governance and politics is something that progresses over time and changes as society changes, as, you know, society advances in different ways and whatnot, or regresses in some ways.
Well, Neil, when it does regress, and I think we've lived through some of this, so I think we're fair to talk on this subject, but I do want to talk about the concept of forgiveness as it appears in the original trilogy, because I, as an enthusiast of force ghosting, through my youth, it was always very interesting to me that at the end of Return of the Jedi, Anakin Skywalker instantly there with Obi-Wan Kenobi and Yoda, two characters that are like peak Jedi, and then boom, here's the only time you get to see Anakin Skywalker with hair, is what it used to be, as a force ghost immediately while his corpse is still burning somewhere on the moon of Endor. And it used to be like that meant that he was redeemed, because we don't see dark side force ghosts really until I guess Clone Wars. And since then, George Lucas has gone back and done a little bit more world building around who could be a force ghost and the training that is required. And we still don't know when Anakin had this training, but it is now assumed, obviously, because he showed up at the end. But let's say the Force is a religion, or at least in these first three movies, it's general enough that you could read the Force as a religion.
Mm-hmm.
does it seem weird to you that Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader, is forgiven? Like, we don't even know any good parts about Anakin at the end of Return of the Jedi. And then as the prequels go on, it doesn't get better for the dude.
I mean, no, especially not if we view it as a religion. And, you know, this might be one of my more deeply Catholic takes, I guess. But I also think this is something that we could very easily categorize as being in the "this is for 12-year-olds" messaging part of Star Wars, which is the way that Anakin Skywalker's journey ends is there to signify that it's never too late to do the right thing.
Okay, yeah.
So even if you're Darth Vader and you've done all the most horrific war crimes, right? Like, the larger context is he was an irredeemable piece of shit. Right. Me, an adult, I can say that. But if I'm a 12-year-old watching that, it's like, okay, so this guy was the most evil dude. We saw him kill a bunch of people. We were told he was the villain the entire time. But he did that one good thing at the end, and his son forgave him. And that is sort of the whole, like, repenting. If you truly repent for your sins, then you will be accepted into the light. Right. That to me is a very deeply religious concept that gets into Star Wars. But it's just as basic as, like, it's never too late to do the right thing and end up on the right side of history. Right. You know, And I think that's true to a great extent. You shouldn't murder people, shouldn't do war crimes. But, like, let's say you're a person who is on the wrong side of anything. Right. It's never too late to evolve on those opinions, and it's never going to be too late to come around to the right side of history, and allow yourself to be changed using things like human empathy, right? And yeah. Using things like familial bonds and wanting to do right by your family and your community and things like that. Cause that's ultimately what drives his decision at the end, right? He's saving his son. He decides that saving his son's life is more important than following his boss.
He makes the exact same decision Luke makes in the middle of Empire Strikes Back, which is, why wouldn't I save this person I love? Which ironically is the thing that makes him Darth Vader in the first place. But we didn't know that at the time.
Sure. Yeah.
But I do like that this is part of the more generalized thing, which is you could always turn against it. And we haven't.
It's harder to explain as in a larger political context, because when you pull out and you really look at it, like, there's not really a whole lot of redeeming Darth Vader. Like, he's a horrible war criminal. If he doesn't die here, he should be in prison. Like, I'm not a big fan of, like, the carceral state, especially having seen Andor and knowing what it's like in this galaxy. But, like, if anybody has to go to jail, it's Anakin Skywalker.
I believe it. Or he could have, you know, been forgiven and not died instantly. And then maybe we could have worked towards some actual forgiveness.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, maybe he's got a long life left in that back to tank, and he's got a redemption arc.
Yeah, he just...
He's going to have to do more than just toss his boss off a ledge.
Exactly. You got to raise a whole Geonosian brood or something. Like, you did some horrible shit, my man.
Yeah. You don't just get to, like, do some paintings after you do all your war crimes, and everybody just forgives you. And it's like, oh, now he's a charming old man. Or maybe you do. We'll come back to George Bush, though.
We will come back to him. I am happy, though, that so far the Anakin that we have seen coming back as a Force ghost has been Ahsoka World Between Worlds content, because I think that means that's slightly more entity, slightly more something. It really would have bothered me if every time we saw Anakin, if we saw Anakin a lot more, like the idea that maybe there was going to be some Anakin Force ghost that would also be a Darth Vader Force ghost in early versions of The Force Awakens is interesting to me. But I do I don't like the idea of him running around telling everybody how forgiven he was as a Force ghost. So I like that when he does show up, it's for a character like Ahsoka, who I think might have the best understanding of who Anakin Skywalker was because of some stuff we're going to talk about right about now. It's time to get into the prequel trilogy. It's a real softball question here, Neil, at the beginning, but The Phantom Menace. I had a big fun time with this because I walked into The Phantom Menace, saw it, was like, what the hell was that? Saw it several times more in the theaters. And the thing that ended tickling me the most pink throughout the entire experience was we had been waiting for so much new Star Wars. And this one starts with a trade blockade on a planet we've never heard of.
Sure.
By like another
embargoes group. And tariffs, baby. Let's
embargoes go. And tariffs. So my understanding of The Phantom Menace is it's primarily a movie to give us a false flag operation that George Lucas decided to also put a tiny slave boy Anakin in. Which plot feels more important to you?
I mean, when you think about the political contexts and ramifications in world, right? If you're treating this as a real world, this story world, it is the false flag. And the not just this as a false flag, right? The Emperor pulling the strings, but like this entire notion that the Emperor has his own full-on deep state level conspiracy with the Sith that is completely unknown to the rest of the governing body of the Senate, which we don't know how big it is. Could be many thousands of senators for all we know. This is never very clear. But like this idea that, you know, there are many, many, there's a spider web of nefarious things that the Emperor has been doing in the background that are basically slowly pushing power in his direction.
Yeah.
And this is something that we can absolutely start to tie to the way the American presidency, for example, has changed since the 1980s, where we've introduced things like the unitary executive theory. Which we used to have this thing when our country was first set up. People love talking about the founding fathers and, you know, those toothless slave owners who wrote the original documents of the United States intended for there to be three branches of government and intended for them to check and balance each other and sort of have equal weight, right? The judiciary, the legislative branch, and the executive. But over this, the last 40 years or so, ever since Ronald Reagan, there's been this growing shift. Crises have happened. Things like COVID have contributed to this. Wars, terrorism, the war on terror was a huge contributor to this. But this idea that solving these crises required the executive branch, the presidency, to have more power. And I think Star Wars in The Phantom Menace gives us the like most extreme accelerated version of that. Like our real world version is just slower.
Right.
Like the Emperor is just more on his game and wants to get it done in his lifetime. It's not a conservative project for him. That's going to pay off, you know, with a candidate somewhere way down the line. He needs to get this shit done now. And so therefore he's going to have more audacious things like the big false flag operation in Naboo. And it's going to lead to democratically elected people handing over more power to him until he has enough power to just take the rest.
Yeah.
You know, they don't need to give him all the power. They just need to give him enough so that he can be like, all right, now I got all the power. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Absolutely. And that happens in like Attack of the Clones. But by that point, it's the start of an empire that he doesn't declare until A New Hope. So there's like years and years where it is the empire in the sense that Palpatine's controlling everything. It just looks like it has the guises of democracy. We were betrayed by the E.T. aliens who cheer at the vote of no confidence of Chancellor Valorum. Steven Spielberg. Anyway, so it's very interesting to me that that's sort of what we rolled out with. And that the other ideas that I think George Lucas also was a little bit interested in, like, how can Anakin Skywalker be made from midichlorians?
To make his religion have like a scientific basis,
right? And I don't think he ever got over that, because I think he accidentally killed off Qui-Gon Jinn, living Force enthusiast, too early, because apparently that's what he wanted his Disney sequels to be about, was to be more about the midichlorians and like go in, which I always thought was a little bit like when Phantom Menace first came out. I will admit I was part of the group that was just like, why did you take this magical thing and try to explain it? But now, especially having the conversation about the Jedi we just had, maybe George Lucas is like, I need to be a little bit more clear about what this shit is that I'm trying to say, because I kind of said don't have attachments to anybody, and maybe it's more about like this thing in your blood. Obviously, there's sort of a whole virgin birth religious thing on that side of it, but then he's like, he's pure midichlorians, so he tries to complicate it a little bit more and maybe get us off of a more Ten Commandments understanding, and at least seeds the idea for those 12-year-olds he thinks is the main thing, that maybe there's something else to study and to pay attention to other than the guy who just refused to get your mom out of slavery but kidnapped you, was like willing to say. I think that's important. I also think it's insane that we're back on Tatooine with the Hutts again, because this is the beginning of problems where it's like, we want to have these things in because they're Star Wars, but them being at this point in Star Wars just makes everybody look horrible. Like, what laws are the Jedi enforcing if they can't stop slavery by the Hutts? Yeah. Why are we helping Jabba the Hutt save his son in the Clone Wars animated movie without any sort of like quid pro quo about why you're just allowed to have like basically a crime syndicate out on the borders beyond our republic, beyond our jurisdiction? They only get like pulled into a conflict when they're sent there by a governing body, which is supposed to look, you know, important, but they have no reason to be there. Which is why the very beneficial creation of the clone army happens in Attack of the Clones, that eventually deploys it. At the end of Attack of the Clones, we get our first listen to the Imperial March as Palpatine watches his clone army head off to battle the Separatists. Let's talk a little bit about Attack of the Clones, because I screw this up in my mind all the time. I'm like, Attack of the Clones was obviously the Iraq War. It came out while it was happening. It was very easy to sit in the theater and be like, oh, this is what we're doing. However, Attack of the Clones written in 2000. So we weren't quite there yet. That was when I went back, read some
interviews. Well, it may just not have been about that Iraq War. Because there was an Iraq War before the mid-90s, I'm old enough to recall.
That's true. I actually think it's the Gulf of Tonkin. I think he went back to Vietnam doing what he knew, which is Gulf of Tonkin, another thing that has since been revealed to have been mostly motivated by the U.S. as an excuse to get further into the Vietnam War. I think the granting of extraordinary powers by Jar Jar Binks is his way to sort of take another run at his original metaphor, which is the America's the empire, and what we are seeing is the Gulf of Tonkin incident. What we didn't know at the time was that the George W. Bush administration would similarly be like, there are weapons of mass destruction over there. They wouldn't even fake incidents. They just said, trust us, it's over there. We have intelligence. Mm-hmm. And that became the thing that was so easy to press on Attack of the Clones. Because although Attack of the Clones is, I think, Gulf of Tonkin adjacent, he does put the false flag in the first movie. So the second movie is more about this clash that eventually happens on the planet of Geonosis, where they need to suddenly have this clone army deployed. We don't get to see that decision made. We just get to see Jar Jar Binks, you know, make his emergency powers, whatnot. We don't see Palpatine be like, all right, send in our troops. They have to just come in and rescue our heroes. And so we're like, yes, this is great. We finally have an army to push back the Separatists. This is where I have a problem about how Attack of the Clones became the Iraq War, despite being written in 2000.
Sure.
Is the language doesn't even make sense. All the separatists are saying is, hey, the Empire or the Galactic Republic is corrupt. We would like to be separate from it. And the Galactic Republic is saying, oh, no, you don't. And is like literally in like forcing planets and systems back into the Galactic Republic, mm-hmm. which is, like we were saying, already an empire, just secretly so. But it is kind of insane to me that the Jedi fight a whole war where they basically go to a planet that's like, we'd like to be free, please. And they're like, no.
Right.
It's very interesting to be anti-imperial in theory when you are forming your empire.
Sure. This is why many of the surviving Jedi after Order 66 all have a drinking problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they get a lot of guilt about their role because they discover that they, you know, even though the stormtroopers are the more obvious perpetrators, right? The clone army is the more obvious perpetrators of the downfall of the Galactic Republic and any semblance of democracy in this galaxy. The Jedi also definitely played a role. But I think you're right. I think George Lucas approached it from the same political lens that he was approaching the original trilogy, just in the sense that, like, the original trilogy shows what happens after the dissolution of the democratically elected government, right? We talked about how A New Hope starts with them dissolving the Senate, but George Lucas was always very fascinated with going back and showing how that happened, how we got to that point. You know, it just involved a lot of trade embargoes. and it sort of stumbles into being relevant to the Iraq War again, because history, like Star Wars trilogies, have this sort of rhyming effect where if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat history, right? If you don't, mm-hmm. if you don't learn how consent is manufactured, for example, for America to get involved in wars that it should not be involved in, then it's going to keep happening, right? It happened in Vietnam, and it very much happened in Iraq multiple times, actually.
And then before I move on to our big question here in the prequel trilogy, which is who's George Bush, I do want to mention the thing I mentioned up at the top, which is in between sort of Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith, we have the events of the Clone Wars, the animated mm-hmm. series. And this is a series that is being produced by Dave Filoni. It is being monitored very closely by George Lucas. George Lucas is funding this to be made, so you don't need to necessarily, you know, be good with a network. They just make entire seasons, and then they're like, hey, do you want to buy the Star Wars series? And some networks like, yes. So in around 2010, in season 3, episode 10 of The Clone Wars, one of my favorite episodes of The Clone Wars, it's called Heroes on Both Sides. And the reason I like it is because it takes this part of the prequels that is never dealt with in the actual movies, because the movies have to be about Anakin Skywalker. Have you ever seen this episode, Neil?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so it takes place, and there's several members of the Senate who are like, we are losing clone troopers. We do not have the money to make more clone troopers, but we need more clone troopers. You know what the problem is we're regulating the banking systems too much. So why don't we deregulate the banks and get some more clone troopers in? And Padme and Bail Organa are like, whoa, 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 let's not necessarily defund any banks. Let's do some investigation into, you know, other ways to maybe the separatists are also, they're facing losses. They're facing monetary losses because they have a droid army, but they still need to build more droids. The Jedi, if you watch the series, go through like, I don't know, 5 dozen droids every time they're in the battle just for one Jedi. So they're like, the separatists, they also must be hurting. Let's go talk to them and see if we could maybe get like a peace deal going on. But members of the Separatists, the Trade Federation, that's good old Newt Gunray from the Phantom Menace, the Techno Union, my favorite, Wat Tambor from Attack of the Clones, and the Intergalactic Banking Clan, which only appears here, so I made sure to include them with your trivia with Adam Garcia, so you at least were aware that they existed, are just not into this idea of suing for peace. So behind the scenes, they decide what they need is an escalation, so they plan an attack on Coruscant to basically do another push to get this these sort of funds released to get the banks deregulated. And I like it because that is not a story about space wizards. That is a story about shit that is happening now. This is the Department of Government Efficiency in Star
that
Wars
is,
The Clone
that
Wars.
That is a story, again, about creating a crisis that manufactures public consent or public sentiment that allows you to do something somewhat extreme to get what you need or get what you want. And to do it through people who, like Padme, who should be on the right side of it, but are, again, being manipulated to work in favor of this this war machine.
Yeah. So that brings us, I mean, another fun thing about it is, obviously, the Clone Wars, this episode came out in 2010. We were done with the prequels at this point, but that did mean they had the hindsight of, oh, this was probably the Iraq War to go back and build on. So there isn't a ton of Dave Filoni in the Disney era coming out and saying political things about Star Wars. But when he was producing shows, he definitely had that thought. And I don't know if it was because George Lucas told him that that was the type of story that maybe animation could tell, or if he decided to like go along with it. But I do know, based on a 2005 interview with Rick McCallum, the producer of the prequel trilogy, and George Lucas, that by the time we get to Revenge of the Sith, that they are definitely like, oh shit, this is George Bush. Rick McCallum is like, there were some parallels in the early movies by accident, but we thought surely somebody else would be elected. We wouldn't have to deal with this again.
Yeah, but then, surely he won't get a second term.
Yeah. But then it happens, so they kind of lean in a little bit, but it's according to George Lucas, Darth Vader is not George. Darth Vader is George Bush because George Bush is kind of an idiot who got drawn into the dark side. It is like the figurehead publicly of all this evil. However, according to him, Dick Cheney is the emperor, which if you didn't live through that administration or haven't seen the movie Vice, then it might be worth reminding people that the vice president, Dick Cheney, had a bunch of dealings that now we know meant that he was running entire parts of the government the vice president usually doesn't run, including many of our secret operations, including the military. So it is interesting that they sort of people assumed that maybe George Bush would be the emperor, especially when George Lucas gives a whole bunch of George Bush-esque lines to Anakin Skywalker, most notably, if you're not with me, you're my enemy, which is a version of something George Bush said at the time, which is, if you're not with us, you're against us, when he was talking about who was and was not supporting our pointless war in Iraq that we said was just on terror in general.
I believe, wasn't that around the time we were changing the name of French fries to Freedom Fries because France didn't want to go along with the invasion of Iraq?
We were very mad at France for a long... Maybe we are still mad at France for that reason.
Well, I'm not. I was never mad at France. They were right.
I went to study abroad in London in 2006, and we were still saying, like, I didn't vote for George W. Bush. Just like that's how you'd start conversations. Yeah. I imagine it's like that around the world now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, listen, if you need more context for this, like if you're a younger person who, again, was lucky enough to not have to live through the George W. Bush presidency, this is the way George Bush was sort of presented to the world, or at least the way his story, the lore of George Bush has been, George W. Bush has been presented, which is that he was just this sort of dopey, nice-ish guy, simpleton guy from Texas, who was eventually corrupted because he was personable, because he was the kind of guy you'd want to have a beer with.
Mm-hmm.
This was a big thing in the Bush years. He was then corrupted by all of these various conservative interests, moneyed interests, military industrial complex interests, and you know, dark forces, many of which were funneled through Dick Cheney. He was then corrupted and turned into the evil. Like, he wasn't the sort of source of all of the evil that his administration did. And I do think that the movie Vice, Adam McKay's best political movie by far, is very illuminating as to like what Dick Cheney's role was there. So like, if you are going to draw parallels, that's absolutely the right parallel, which is Cheney is as the emperor sort of manipulating things where people can't see him.
Mm-hmm.
And George Bush as more of the out and about figurehead of everything they were doing, because he sort of had the more palpable brand, I guess. Which isn't the case for Vader, but Vader has a sort of different outward public situation where he's very specifically feared. And I believe when we see him move about the political world, is sort of treated as like this outside entity, right? Is separate from the emperor and is sort of his own sort of, has his own like religious zealotry pocket of the empire that he works with.
He's doing the exact same thing the Jedi were doing. He's just not, he has no bones about what he's actually doing.
Yeah, exactly.
He's just going, everyone else just seems
cool with it because they're scared.
He's there to kidnap Force children and subjugate worlds. And that is what the Jedi were doing a couple movies ago. So it's very interesting to see. I think the prequel trilogy, the most interesting Star Wars movies to talk about, the worst Star Wars movies. I know that's not a controversial take.
But I also think that, you know, now that we've gotten through the original trilogy and the prequel trilogy, when we talk about the sequel trilogy, it'll be interesting because one of the things that George Lucas was able to do, and this is why you can't say that these movies are not political, is that he infused so many political ideas into these stories that even when other Star Wars things try not to be political, they can't run away from some of these ideas.
Right.
These ideas still end up in there because they're foundational to this universe, right? Like, you can't look at the First Order, for example, and not see Nazis, because that's sort of the in-world aesthetic that fascism takes.
Mm-hmm.
And even if the sequel trilogy isn't quite as interested in how the First Order came to power and how they control power, or like what the New Republic did to allow them to come back into power, you still very immediately recognize that these are the fascists.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
And like, when the first Order Stormtrooper photos came out, I'm like, it's actually kind of smart to make like iPod Stormtroopers. Mm-hmm. Like, what can we market them as, like, slightly more sleek as? Why the not as clumsy as the old like Nazis? And like the whole like floating mass design, I kind of dig it. It's I dig what it's going for. It doesn't make things less complex politically. Sure. Let's talk about how we got there a little bit. So when the prequels came out, people didn't like it, and people were like, George Lucas, go sit on it. You don't know what your Star Wars is about. This is not my Star Wars. You don't know what to do with this franchise. You should have just done nothing. There was a whole documentary that's out that I rewatched recently called The People versus George Lucas. And at the time, mm-hmm. I was like, this is interesting. This is a documentary about the age-old debate about if you could separate the art from the artist. And if so, when does the artist's ownership over that change? Mm-hmm. Having since gone back to watch The People versus George Lucas, it is like some of the worst, some of the people who would become in the following decade the worst people on the internet.
Sure.
Given a space to validate their ideas. So I've sort of come around on this idea of the fandom menace, because I do think ultimately it's making a Make America Great Again argument, which is that our Star Wars was better back then before you made it whatever, digital, about the Iraq War, with bad actors, like you name it, we leveled it at the Phantom Menace and then the resulting prequels. So Neil,
sure.
Did Disney sort of like cave to this group, and by trying to go like the J.J. Abrams route to trying to give us like scary Darth Vader back again, is it ultimately giving in to the MAGA movement?
I mean, I think it was a bit of a process, and I don't want to let George Lucas completely off the hook here, because I do think that he, in the way that he handled the franchise before he sold it to Disney, did sort of walk into this a little bit, right? The special editions being, I think, the most glaring example of like him wanting to go back and do another pass on the way those movies looked, and wanting and that not being super successful, you know, for many fans, right? This idea that of him wanting to keep going back and changing that, and that is fans objecting to artistic decisions that he is making, like and to a large extent, a fairly legitimate criticism, right? You either like the special edition changes or you don't, but that's fine either way. It's legit. You're actually commenting on changes to the movie. And I do think that stuff like that led people to being antagonistic towards George Lucas and the Star Wars franchise. And what that did is it sort of opened this door for that sort of energy to be co-opted by a few other movements that started to rise up around the time that Disney purchased Star Wars. And I think that Gamergate is very important here, because Gamergate is very foundational to the way MAGA operates online. I don't know if it's as foundational to the way MAGA operates like in the real world.
Right.
But definitely on social media, it is very influential. And Gamergate, for anybody who doesn't know, is this from the early 2000s, this movement primarily driven by men online in the gaming space to push back. I'm going to be very generous with this description, to push back on the influx of women in their industry. It's a bunch of dudes who were mad that there are girls playing games and making games and being involved in games criticism.
And surely good reviews of those games were because they would
use their
feminine wiles.
And they were mad that women were now main characters of games that they weren't going to play anyway. But and they used this, they created many bad faith arguments to create this sort of anti-feminist movement, and which eventually became this like anti-SJW movement. This is a big Gamergate thing, anti-social justice warrior, where they labeled anyone who would, for example, show human empathy toward anyone who's different, anyone who didn't fit the sort of traditional expectations that you would have of a gamer, the cis white dudes who dominate the space and still to this day dominate the majority of those spaces. That if you were a person who expressed any sort of empathy to those points of view, or a person who supported diversity in any way in the gaming space, that you were a warrior on the other side of the cause, and you were meant to be dealt with the maximum aggression, right? And this is where stuff like swatting came from, right? Where people will call the police on people online and like have like SWAT teams show up at other people's houses just to like fuck with them. This is where doxing became a big thing, where people would take anonymous people in the gaming space and put their personal private information out there for everyone to see. It created stalking. There were many figures, targets of the Gamergate movement, who got death threats. And, you know, stop me if this sounds familiar to what happened eventually to people who made Star Wars things. Not necessarily because, and what's interesting about it is that it's not because the Star Wars sequel series itself has more political content.
Right.
It is because these people, these movements, decided that Star Wars was being made with an agenda, that Disney had this agenda to drive out the perspective of this cisgendered white guy and replace it with a bunch of blue-haired bisexuals. Mm-hmm. And that really is an animating thing for a lot of very lonely, sad men online, and it was at the time. And this is a thing that was easily able to like slither its way in and kind of co-opt the negative energy towards Star Wars and begin to sort of fester with people in this pool of discontent that may have started as, I don't want Disney to own Star Wars. I don't like the way George Lucas dealt with the special editions. I don't like that they're killing all of the canon books that I spent my childhood reading. Shit like that. Like, legitimate, I'm a fan, and I don't like what they're doing to my childhood stuff.
Things we say about The Last of Us and House of the Dragon that are normal about it.
Legitimate criticisms about the thing, the art, to then sort of take that and co-opt it and turn it into something else, to turn it into this idea that it is feminism that is ruining your Star Wars, not like capitalism, for example. Right. Like, I am very sympathetic to the idea that Disney has done bad things to the Star Wars franchise. Like, a perfectly good example is they have sort of neutered any of the sharpness to any political messages that the Star Wars movies had, right? They're not interested in the politics of the world quite as much. They don't really have as much to say. They are leaning more heavily into these are adventure stories for 12-year-olds than even George Lucas's originals. And I don't personally like that, because that is a corporation sanitizing a story that has much more to say. So, but I don't think that it's because there are more women in the field, right? I don't think that's because there's like a feminist ideology running through the halls of Disney's executive offices that are making them want to diversify things, you know, diversify their movies. And I'm not gonna sit here and like blame all of my life's problems on that, which is what some of these movements, Gamergate, that has evolved into the alt-right that we have now, that's sort of the extreme they've taken it to. But you know, it was and Gamergate's a thing that was like fully going by the time we get to 2015 and you know, The Force Awakens.
Well, so, and we have a whole bunch of what's eventually going to become Me Too that is also going to cause a backlash, because how dare they try to take down like powerful people men.
Stand up for themselves.
So yeah, there's a bunch of stuff that gets wrapped up, but I do think it's interesting that the fandom menace is part of the thing that you outlined very much specifically, where it's part of a entitlement of a person who is not actually involved in the thing. And I think several times that entitlement leads to like a bad faith reading. For instance, I think Star Wars gets this in 2016, while most of Disney doesn't until after like the political climate changes. Mm-hmm. Because in 2016, like, the liberals are like, hey, this is, you know, great. Everybody watched Force Awakens. People, at the time it came out, really liked The Force Awakens, because the prequels, again, movies we didn't like. So we were kind of on this side. But once something like The Last Jedi hits and doesn't necessarily say stuff that they want about the man, Luke, it becomes the woman, Kathleen Kennedy's problem.
Sure.
Which, like, all of these decisions are so much more complex than that, but it is super easy to be like, oh, the woman who's running the part of Disney we have a problem with now, go for it. Sure. Iron Man 2 was bad, but no one was like, Kevin Feige, stop, you know?
Yeah.
Well, we're on a high.
And what's funny is that The Last Jedi of the three is the one that has the most to say. Like, it's not interested in, like, the senatorial politics of its era, but it is interested in, like, what the Force's role is in all this and whether there are, like, truly, like, chosen ones or whether anyone can be chosen. And I think that's all, like, super interesting stuff, but that's not even what people were mad about.
Right.
People were just mad because Luke Skywalker didn't do enough cool shit and the lead was a lady. Right. And they were,
which,
like,
it had
that's
been
where
before, but they were
as
like,
deep as their criticism went.
The Force Awakens ends in a way where it's like, I know you just sat through a movie where your lead protagonists were a black stormtrooper, a Hispanic pilot, and a woman, but don't worry, Luke's here. And then at the beginning of Last Jedi, it turns out, oh, not the Luke you thought, though, and we're off to the races once again.
And really, the only people that have a problem with stuff like that from The Force Awakens are the people who have a problem that people like that exist.
Right.
Right? Like, you only have a problem with the ending of The Force Awakens if, like, the existence of women or black people or Hispanic people is a problem for you. I can tell you from personal experience, if it's not a problem for you, it's just a movie.
Yeah.
It's just a movie about people resisting fascism, which is the message we should have been concerned about in 2015.
That's very true. So then, of course, Last Jedi happens. We have a little bit of a backlash. Disney, obviously, even currently now, having a problem with the administration. Disney, much different than George Lucas. George Lucas, very rich man. Disney basically owns part of the state of Florida, is involved with billions and billions of dollars of other things. So they have sort of slowed, with the exception, I do want to say, we're on the tail end of our Andor Season 2 podcast. That's great. Andor, great. Can't believe they snuck that through. But most of what Disney was thinking was maybe we could put a gay kiss in The Rise of Skywalker, and everybody was like, no, and we hate your movie. So there is a success story on the tail end of this.
Sure.
They might have fumbled the legacy characters a little bit, but on Disney Plus, they were able to come up with somebody that we called for a year and a half Baby Yoda, but it turns out its name's Grogu. I would argue the, like, pinnacle of Star Wars success was pivoting to something you could sell that wasn't Darth Vader, R2-D2, the Millennium Falcon. They shoved the Millennium Falcon in a solo prequel movie. The Death Star's in Andor. There's so much previous thing that was like their adaptation of a currently existing thing. They even still do it in like The Mandalorian when we get like Dark Troopers here sort of rescued, quote unquote, from the Legends. But Grogu's his own thing.
Mm-hmm. He's so new merch. Like,
Grogu's his own thing, his own merch. You can meet him in Disneyland. Do you think Grogu has any politics?
I mean, I don't think... This is a question about that to me leads to a bigger question about Dave Filoni.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned when we talked about the Clone Wars series that he did seem to be a little bit more interested in the politics of this story world when he was directly under George Lucas.
Yeah.
But I don't feel the same way necessarily about The Mandalorian as a franchise that he's interested in the politics. There is some stuff where he's like exploring Mandalorian society's internal conflict, right? Mm-hmm. Should we be warriors who are doing a bunch of killing? Should we be pacifists? That stuff, fine. But it's not about the broader galaxy. And Grogu's a good example of this because, I mean, obviously he can't talk to tell us what his ideology is. But you would imagine that as someone who has the trauma of surviving Order 66, right? That's his origin story.
Yeah.
That he would have potentially some radical politics toward, you know, the return of the Empire, right? And I think The Mandalorian being set in the time period that it is sort of gives them space to explore how this ideology came back in the galaxy, but also it's still kind of far enough away from the sequel trilogy where it gives them an out where they're like, well, a bunch of stuff could happen in between here and then. So like,
we don't have to do it all
while we're doing our, you know, space cowboy show. So I think that if Grogu did, he would have very interesting politics, but I don't think that like Dave Filoni is interested in that yet. It'll be interesting to see if that changes when you get to a movie.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, that's another thing watching, going from watching Andor to watching Rogue One, like immediately after that, is that when you make a Star Wars movie, as opposed to a television show, you do have to leave quite a bit of the nuance behind these days, because you have to do the big action stuff and you got to get the big cameos in. And that's all fine because people are paying money to go see it in a theater and you want to give them their money's worth. But the movies generally zoom out to the larger conflicts, the larger parts of the conflict, and involve the more galaxy-wide situations.
Yeah.
And so if Grogu and his adoptive dad, Mr. Fantastic, are going to like have a bigger adventure in the Star Wars galaxy, they're going to run up against some of these ideas.
Right? Yes.
You know, they're not going to be able to like avoid it or just stick to like the interpersonal Mandalorian conflicts about whether they should be Ronin or not.
I mean, a Ronin cult is weird, but also like far enough astray that I'm fine with it. Like, I want my Wolf and Cub Star Wars series too. I'm not going to question it.
Yeah.
However, I do feel like as it gets bigger, like you're saying, into a movie, they're going to have a choose a side moment. And they have, you know, previously where they're like, we're not going to join Cara Dune and her New Republic Rangers. And good thing we got all that canceled. So it doesn't matter what or not. But sure. Like, I'm pretty sure Sigourney Weaver's playing like a New Republic pilot in this one. So they're going to come across, do you do your jobs for the government? And I think that's what Mandalorian and Grogu at least is going to brush up against. It is going to have a lot of action sequences, but I am curious.
And that alone is probably going to tell us more about the New Republic than we got from the entire sequel trilogy.
Yes.
Because like when you think back about the New Republic and the sequel trilogy, it's like they just get blown up.
Yeah, immediately.
Immediately.
There's some other side story things, but New Republic has big 2025 Democrats energy where they just have no idea what to do. Yeah. So I am interested to see how that develops and how they got there. And what is bad enough to work for the government if you don't want to work for the government? What's the opposing force? I'm very interested to see if the Mandalorian versus Grogu accidentally gets political again because they need to, like you said, stroll into the bigger conflict.
Sure. Or if Disney remains confident enough to let him go into that. Because the other question is like about Andor.
Go ahead.
Is like, why would Disney let them get political, this political all of a sudden? Right. And I actually think that this similar to me. Remember the movie Nomadland
with Chloe Zhao,
Frances McDormand. Yeah, Chloe Zhao's movie, where it's basically a very significant criticism of companies like Amazon. But Amazon is featured in the movie, right? Like she works at the Amazon place, and people are like, "Why would Amazon do this?" It's because Amazon's not scared. Right. Yeah. They don't care that you know that they exploit workers because they are so big and so powerful that they don't fear repercussions. And I do think that there is a certain point with a company like Disney where it's like they could even make some anti-capitalist art and it's not going to lead to negative repercussions for the Disney machine. So they're going to get credit for making some punk rock political drama, even though they are the empire, even though they are in capitalistic terms the evil empire, and that's why you could see the Mandalorian kind of wading into it and trying to, you know, bite off a little bit of that Andor success as well if they can do it in a smart way. But you know, we'll see.
Yeah, I would love that. Unfortunately, it looks like other things in Disney are sort of complying in advance on like the Pixar and Marvel side. So we'll see where we're going.
Yeah,
maybe, but there is some hope for Mandalorian and Grogu.
They're out on supporting LGBTQ plus people, and they're in on like anti-capitalism, anti-fascism stuff.
That would because be regrounding maybe they feel back like, in Star Wars, like we were talking about.
And maybe they feel like that's safer ground from a corporate standpoint, from a corporate image standpoint.
I think there's...
You know, I think it's gross either way. So.
I do think it'd be gross. I would...
It's gross to calculate that way.
I would be interesting if there was all of a sudden one Star Wars movie that was like, no, that president is bad. I'd be like, what the fuck are you doing? I'd watch it like three times because I'd be like, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, who knows? There are definitely movies that are like, hey, Nixon is bad. And that's how this all started. There just weren't contemporary movies that said it was Nixon, except maybe Star Wars. So like that's sort of the same situation that we could be in with further Star Wars movies if they want. It seems like they could have some success there because all of these movies that we have talked about, because we haven't talked about Rise of Skywalker, were basically successes. Mm-hmm. So as we head out, I've got one more question for you, Neil, and I shoehorned this one in early this morning, so I hope that you had time to consider it. But let me tell you how I got here. Who are you in political Star Wars? Because I realized last night trying to chart out basically a monologue about the prequels that I am the last Jedi Luke Skywalker, who is just like in a young farm boy doing his theater in Louisville, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And is like, you know, I'm going, Iraq War starts and I'm like, no blood for oil shirts. I'm like, I'm going to go to New York and go to NYU and go to like protest the DNC in like 2004. And I'm like, screw this. I'm going to be the change. We're going to defeat George W. Bush. We are going to take down the previous Bush and Reagan that my parents voted for. This is it. We're going to do it for humanity. And my way through that was by embracing my friends and not listening to what other people were telling me. Because when I was graduating high school, the internet was a new thing, was not taken seriously. All the time I was spending on screens, they thought was ridiculous. You're supposed to go get a job. You're supposed to be like an engineer or a lawyer. They basically were trying to put me in like the tech bro pipeline. But I'm like, no, I'm going to go fight the world through my art. I graduated from NYU. The next year, we elected Barack Obama with one of the largest internet campaigns ever. And I was like, fuck yeah, we did it. First black president, something that wasn't even possible with you old farts. And I only did it because I didn't listen to you guys. Whoop, whoop. Maybe forgot my father or forgave my father and let him burn and then become a force ghost. That's neither here nor there. But Obama won. Great. Now people are like, okay, younger generation, what are you going to do with this? And that is when I wasn't in a position of fear anymore. I wasn't the rebel anymore. I had won. I had beaten the empire in a very vague sense. And so then I got to the business of untangling the empire. And that involves learning history, which involves learning things about the parties that I thought I was affiliated with that I didn't like. And discovering, as we've been hopefully preaching to you this whole time, the nuance of the real world as opposed to the very easy decisions I could make, no blood for oil, etc. All of a sudden we're in, you know, who gets access to healthcare? And Barack Obama basically proposes a Republican plan because the Republicans stop him. Blah, 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 blah. I get disillusioned with the whole thing. And I was like, oh, I didn't defeat the Democrats. The Democrats recruited me when I was powerful enough to do something for them. And now I'm not sure if I buy into this whole thing. I don't know if the Jedi Order is actually for me. And then I go off and just get crazy with it and kind of hermit myself off from a lot of political opinions in general. I very quietly voted for Barack Obama a second time, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that puts me in the last Jedi Luke position, because now there's a whole bunch of people coming up. And the thing that I'm doing is the thing that people didn't like about Luke, which is I'm a little like all you young, excited people. You haven't seen the things I've seen. And my hope for me is at the end of The Last Jedi, not only does Yoda tell Luke that Rey has all she needs, which is a love for her friend and the ability to reach to the dark side to maybe get Ben, to not let Ben go. Maybe that's all she needs. And Lucas comes up somehow with a non-violent way of stopping the First Order on Crait and sacrifices himself doing it. That's like the best hope I have politically going forward. I'm not helping my case with a Storm of Spoilers political Star Wars special and laying this out, but I did, as I sort of like looked at Luke's story over Luke's chronological story, where he starts off knowing nothing and ends realizing that it should have been a nonviolent sacrifice the whole time and let the youth lead. I hope that could be me in political Star Wars. And
all right.
I encourage you to challenge me on that if I start turning a little too Sith while I'm doing it, because there is something to be said about using power to crush my enemies, but I just don't think that's necessarily as helpful as I thought it would be when I was 18.
Sure. Well, as long as you're able to control your emotions at all times, you'll be fine.
Cool. Yeah, definitely. No problem with that. Neil, do you have somebody who you identify with politically in the long arc of Star Wars?
Absolutely. Mine is Han Solo, but not just any Han Solo. I'm talking Force Awakens Han Solo. And I guess Han Solo from, you know, I'm not a dashing smuggler, unfortunately, but he's a guy that I think throughout his entire arc in this story would probably rather be doing anything else.
Yeah.
With his bud Chewie, and would rather be out there living a very free life, being just dashing all across the galaxy, but keeps getting sucked in because deep down he knows what the right thing is. And so sort of keeps getting infected by hope occasionally across his life. And a lot of times that infection is related to a lady that he likes.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that over the course of my life. So the up and down arc of Han Solo and his involvement, which is like this state of slight detachment, but also can't help himself but get involved at the right moment. But by the time he gets to The Force Awakens, he is this sort of gruff guy who has learned a great deal of powerful lessons that he can impart on the next generation, right? He seems to have a pretty good handle on what the Force is at that point, and seems to still have that healthy skepticism of the entire Enterprise. But again, get sucked into doing the right thing because it is the right thing. And I think there's this quality to him in The Force Awakens where it's like a recognition of how potentially hopeless the situation is. Hopeless the situation is. But the I guess will to keep going anyway. You know, even to continue to try and help push the light side along, even if it all feels very hopeless, even if you're about to get killed off in the first third of the story, you know. And I feel like for me, a lot of modern life feels that way, which is like at any moment in this story of modern American life, I could very easily be killed off. So you got to just keep going until that happens, right?
Yeah.
you have kind of no choice but to engage with the world around you and engage with the sort of overwhelming barrage of heinous shit that happens in our lives. But you can't let that turn you into someone who is completely detached, because you know then your Princess Leia is very lonely. She's without you, and then she dies. Well, then you die, and then she dies, and then everybody's just dead.
Well, then you get to come back as the one not Force user, Force ghost. It's very confusing.
I guess that's true. I mean,
I will say Force Awakens Han is a great time, because you know what Han's done in between Return of the Jedi and Force Awakens. Smuggling. He and Chewie went back and liberated Kashyyyk.
Yeah, okay. So he's doing stuff for his friends.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most important thing. I just want to hang out with Chewie.
I like that. You know what I'll also add to that? Han Solo trusts his friends.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
And I think that's also great. My guy was a little too paranoid of everything. I like that you are making it a bit more of a community, even if you aren't making the best choices all the time. I think great thing to see in yourself.
He's the kind of guy that even if he's going to get killed off early, he's made an impact, and he's going to keep trying all the way to the end there.
Well, guys, you should let us know who you think you are in Star Wars and why. I would be very interesting to hear. EA, if you had Star Wars-like lives that you have no reason to tell us until now, that sounds super exciting. If you blew up an oil pipeline one time after living on a farm because, you know, the cops burned your aunt and uncle, that would be, I'd love to meet you. And two, I think it's interesting to continue this discourse outside of Star Wars in your real life. It might be hard to have political conversations with people in this climate if you're just like, did you see the news? But you know what? Lots of people have seen and had very complex emotions with Star Wars. And if you could see them, I think that's also one of the great things about fandom, if not necessarily something great about politics.
I think that's a good point and a really good place to sort of end on, Dave, which is don't take it too seriously.
Yeah.
It does concern me. I get concerned for people when they take stuff like Star Wars and turn that into part of their political identity and try to use it going in that direction, right? Using Star Wars to sort of explain their own political ideology in the real world. Your real world politics have to be based on real world things.
Yes.
But especially if you can use it in ways to create analogies to be able to connect with other people who maybe don't share your politics and help them understand your politics and maybe help bring them to your side. If Star Wars is an easier reference point, use Star Wars.
Yeah. I 100% agree with you. And if you are listening to us on podcast, we can't wait to hear from you. If you're watching us on YouTube, you might notice from Neil and I's shirts, there's one category of people that you don't have to listen to. But other than that, we will be back here on this feed talking to you about the Alien franchise. Surely nothing political in that, Neil.
Oh, yeah. Nothing political. Spaceships, though.
You know, but we do get to do some more spaceships and some fun things that we didn't really get to do here with Andor, which is creature design. Some of these new invasive species going to be pretty cool. So just a reminder, we'll be back with our preview episode on the 6th of August. Until then, go out there and be excellent to each other.